Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Each year, approximately 70,000 women in the United States are diagnosed with a cancer of the reproductive organs. One cancer, cervical cancer, can now be largely prevented, and the rates of this cancer are declining as the use of a vaccine against an infection caused by human papillomavirus increases. For those women with cervical cancer, treatment is advancing in some amazing way thanks to a deeper understanding of the HPV virus and how our immune system works. This program is primarily going to be discussing gynecological cancers, or I should say we'll be discussing gynecological cancers, but primarily we're going to talk about cervical cancer, its causes, its prevention, and really hopefully have our listeners understand some really cutting-edge immune therapy for cervical cancer. Our guests are in the studio is Anchorage gynecologic oncologist, Dr. Melissa Hardesty, and joining us by phone from his office at the National Cancer Institute is research oncologist, Dr. Christian Hendricks. Welcome to both of you. It's a pleasure to have you join us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Melissa, let's start with you, if you don't mind telling us a little bit about what you do, how you got up here, and why you ended up as a gynecologic oncologist.
Sure. I've been in Alaska about 2.5 years now. I came here from the University of Washington, where I finished a fellowship in gynecologic oncology. I started my training on the East Coast, doing a residency in Pennsylvania. And after residency, I had a 4-year National Health Service commitment, and I went to rural Arizona and worked with a lot of members of the Navajo Nation doing general OBGYN. And after I finished that commitment, I went back to University of Washington and finished a fellowship in women's cancer surgery and completed a master's in public health at the University of Washington. And after I finished that training, I was really looking to get back into a similar environment where I would be in a more remote area, and I knew that there was a physician in Alaska, and Dr. Hope had been up here, and so I came up a couple years ago to join her at the Alaska Women's Cancer Care Office, which is in the Providence Cancer Center. And we primarily take care of gynecologic cancers, either patients that come to us with a known gynecologic cancer or a suspected cancer or a worrisome mass or a complex surgical history. So most of our patients have either gynecologic cancer or a complex pelvic surgery situation. The cancers that we primarily are going to take care of are, as you mentioned, women's reproductive health organs. That's mostly going to be endometrial or uterine cancer. Second on the list that we see would be ovarian cancer and fallopian tube cancer, which are similar. And then cervical cancer, as you mentioned, which is decreasing in its frequency thanks to vaccination and, of course, pap smears. And then we also see external cancers, which is a vulvar cancer, and then rare. Rarely you can see vaginal cancers, which are in the vaginal tube.
Okay, thanks. And what's unique, I learned from Joni Hope's interview a couple years ago, is that you all are surgeons and oncologists, which is, to my experience, is a little different. Most of the oncologists are medical people, internists, and then there's surgeons involved. But this specialty has evolved with really, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, surgeons being trained to also do the oncology or the cancer treatment as well.
That is true. And I think that comes somewhat, it sort of naturally extends itself from OBGYN training as well. Those of us that initially started off in OBGYN, that is also a relatively unique specialty where the same physicians will do the general medical care, but yet do surgeries that are related to people's gynecologic problems and do deliveries and obstetrics, and there's surgeries associated with that. And so when you get into a subspecialization of OBGYN, which is GYN oncology, I think that a lot of the evolution of that specialty kind of came from that mindset. And it works out well because ovarian cancer specifically lends itself to a woman being under the care of somebody who's trained both in the surgery and the chemotherapy for this condition, because it is not unfrequent for someone to have ovarian cancer undergo surgery. They almost always require chemotherapy to follow, but it's not unfrequent for those women to require additional surgeries moving forward. And so it's a lot more comprehensive care for the woman to have all of that care being seen by a single physician rather than going kind of back and forth between a medical and surgical oncologist. Similarly, occasionally cervical and endometrial cancer require chemotherapy. And so I think it gives us a little bit more continuity of care with the patients.
Sure, sure. Dr. Henricks, let's ask you the same thing. You mind just briefly bringing us up to speed on how you ended up at the National Cancer Institute and what you're doing there?
I've had an unusual career path. I initially trained as a cancer surgeon, and in doing so, I learned a lot about the limits of what surgery can accomplish in cancer and even what standard cancer treatments can accomplish. And I wanted to at least explore and see what cancer research is like. So I went to the NIH and joined the surgery branch for a fellowship that was partially in clinical cancer surgery, but largely in immunology and immune-based cancer treatments. And I ended up doing cancer research in a laboratory there for 6 years. And that research was focused on ways to make T cells that we were infusing into patients to treat their cancers stronger. But it was somewhat difficult to apply my findings in the clinic because we didn't have a good clinical research model setting in which to test these discoveries. And so I felt there was a real need for different clinical research that would set up a model where we could test what we were doing in the lab to see if it would actually improve the treatments. Around that time, I also lost my right eye to a rare eye cancer, which made it so that I couldn't operate anymore. And I decided to retrain in internal medicine and medical oncology. And that was so that I would be able to do clinical trials in a model of cancer where we'd be able to test the findings we'd been developing in the lab. And while I was retraining in internal medicine and medical oncology, I spent much of that time thinking and studying different types of cancers and deciding which kinds of cancers would be best to treat with these T-cell-based approaches that we were developing. So after I finished training, I came back to clinical research, and I started clinical trials for HPV cancers. And the reason why I was studying these cancers caused by HPV, it's human papillomavirus, was because these cancers look to the immune system much like viruses, like cells that are infected with viruses. And I thought that it made sense to try to target these cancers with immune therapies and try to get the immune system to eliminate them the same way that it would eliminate virally infected cells. And so that's what I do now. In the laboratory, I discover new treatments for virally associated cancers, primarily those caused by human papillomavirus. And then when I make discoveries in the laboratory, I take them to clinical trials and test whether they work in patients.
All right. For the rest of the program, just for listeners, what we're going to do is we're going to talk briefly about signs and symptoms of gynecologic cancers. And then we're going to move on to spend quite a bit of time on cervical cancer and human papillomavirus. And we'll explain T cells. We'll try to get into some brief understanding of the immune system so that it's not, it should be, if I'm doing my job well, minimal and learnable from everybody who's listening. But before I do that, I need to remind everybody with questions or comments during the next hour, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. And it'll only be during this next hour to 45 minutes that we'll be available to answer your questions. In Anchorage, you can call 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, and you have to spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Hardesty, go over the major groupings of reproductive organ cancers, and what we're interested in is symptoms. How does a woman know she should be concerned if she has certain symptoms that this might need to be investigated?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. The most common cancer that we encounter regarding women's reproductive health organs would be uterus cancer. That typically is cancer that arises from the lining of the interior part of the uterus, and that part of the uterus is called endometrium. And endometrial cancer, luckily, is a cancer that frequently makes itself obvious early on in the disease process. And the reason for that is because the inside of the uterus has an exit pathway to the world. And so when these cancers arise, they tend to be associated with bleeding, and women will experience bleeding and bring that to their physician's attention. So most women that have endometrial cancer are going to be coming to their physicians complaining about bleeding after menopause. That's going to be the most common symptom. And I think it's important that women remember that anything that comes out of their vagina that is brown or pink or pink-tinged, that is bleeding after menopause. So it does not have to get to the volume of being a menstrual flow. Even the lightest amount of bleeding is not normal after a woman has reached menopause. And menopause would be after you have not had any periods for a period of greater than a year. So if you experience any bleeding after menopause, that is definitely something that you ought to bring to the attention of your physician. But unfortunately, we are seeing endometrial or uterine cancer in a higher and higher frequencies in younger women. And I think that this is something that historically has been more difficult to diagnose because physicians are often operating under the premise that this abnormal bleeding represents other more typical gynecologic cancers. So the most important thing is that if you're a younger woman and you have not yet experienced the menopause or no periods for a year, if you have bleeding that's happening outside of the context of a regular monthly period that's average length, you know, I would say less than 10 days. If you're experiencing more than 10 days a month of bleeding or a tremendous amount of spotting or bleeding between your periods, that is definitely something to discuss with your provider as to what the cause might be. And doing a biopsy of the uterus is something that is pretty straightforward and often can be done in the office with a small amount of cramping. So that is those are the most common symptoms of uterus cancer. Some people do experience cramping. Some people do, instead of bleeding, come in complaining of discharge. But there's no question about the fact that bleeding that's happening in an abnormal pattern is going to be the most common symptom there. The second most common cancer that we see is ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer traditionally was always thought to have come from the peritoneal surface over the ovary, but more recently we're coming to increasing understanding that a large portion of what was traditionally called ovarian cancer is actually arising from the end of the fallopian tube. And I think the main problem with these particular cancers are they're arising on surfaces in the abdominal cavity, and so they don't really have a container to get out of in the same way that other cancers do. And unfortunately, what that means is oftentimes when we diagnose ovarian cancer, we diagnose it at a stage 3 or 4. In fact, that's going to be probably where 75% of these patients are presenting.
By stage 3 or 4, you mean they have metastasis outside?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Within the abdominal cavity is the most common place. Women who develop ovarian cancer typically have complaints of abdominal pain, pelvic pain and pressure. They often have changes in what's going on with their bowel or bladder function, so difficulty going to the bathroom, voiding or peeing more often than they were before, or just peeing differently, or, you know, things that go on for longer than a couple of weeks that are not going away. GI or gastrointestinal symptoms are also pretty common. People feel bloated. They eat, and when they eat, they get full pretty quickly. These are all symptoms that warrant further evaluation. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, most ovarian cancers are diagnosed at a more advanced stage. Pelvic exam is often a helpful way to diagnose ovarian cancers earlier, although unfortunately we don't at this time have any really good proven screening strategies to help us identify ovarian cancer early. So that's the second most common cancer that we see. Cervical cancer is the third most common cancer that we see, and thankfully in this day and age, the vast majority of cervical cancers that we see are detected on routine Pap smear screening. And when they're detected on routine Pap smear screening, they're typically earlier stage. We do, although not unfrequently, see women present at more advanced stages. A lot of these women have access to healthcare problems, and because of that, are not getting routine screening, typically uninsured, or live in geographical areas where getting routine Pap smears is more difficult. People that have more advanced stages of cervical cancer, the most common sort of pathognomonic symptom is going to be really having spotting between your periods or after intercourse is the one that I think that is the thing you'd read in most in a textbook. Pelvic pain and vaginal discharge are also very common symptoms of cervical cancer. And then last but not least would be vulvar cancers. Vulvar cancers are typically found by the woman noticing that there is a lump or a growing area on the skin on the outside of their vagina. So the word vulva basically refers to the outside part of the female anatomy, the labia and the mons. And when you have an itchy lesion there or an itchy spot that's growing or bleeding, that's the most common symptom of vulvar cancer. And then a vaginal cancer would be in the vagina itself. And that's, again, something that if it has symptoms would typically be bleeding or discharge and is often detected during a pelvic exam.
Let's go back then to cervical cancer a little bit. And if you don't mind, it seems to be a relatively rare one. I mean, a common one, it seems, from listening to you. Who gets it? What are the age group that you see cervical cancer? And then, if you don't mind, at the same time, what are thought to be or known to be causes of this cancer?
So cervical cancer affects about one out of every 150 women. It is the cancer that we unfortunately often will see in our younger patients. Most of the time it happens after the age of 30, but it is occasionally diagnosed in women under the age of 30. It, I think, is most commonly seen in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I think the prevalence of it goes down slightly after that, although I don't have those numbers directly in front of me. As we're going to spend a lot of time talking about moving forward, cervical cancer, all of it, is caused by a virus called human papillomavirus, and I'm going to defer to my esteemed colleague to talk more about that. But this virus is something that a large number of people acquire earlier on in life, and when I say a large number of people, the number going around fluctuates, but typically is in the 75 to 80% range of people at some point in their life have been exposed to HPV. And most people, when they get exposed to HPV, clear that infection. And that means that their body's immune system basically gets rid of the virus that causes the HPV virus. But occasionally that virus will be taken up by cells in the female genital tract, specifically the cervix, vagina, or vulva. And in that process can over time become a cervical cancer. There are definitely things that can make that process more successful for the virus. So I think most of those relate to the immune function of the woman. Interestingly enough, this is one cancer where we really clearly have a link between smoking and the development of these cancer and precancer lesions. So women who smoke cigarettes are definitely at an elevated risk of developing cervical cancer. And cervical cancer makes its way to cancer through a precancer process that's referred to as dysplasia. And there's no question about the fact that smoking makes it more challenging for your body to eradicate the abnormal cells as they make their way through this process. Other things that can do it would be things that are less in a person's control, perhaps other medical problems that they might have that affect their immune system, some autoimmune diseases. Certainly, this is something that we see that can become a very aggravating problem for people undergoing transplants or that have other immune deficiencies such as HIV. So those types of things can make the individual patient's likelihood for developing cervical cancer elevated.
Okay. I'm going to ask Dr. Henrich to talk about the HPV virus a little bit more in just a second, but I also want to remind listeners again, this is Line 1, your health connection. Our topic today is primarily cervical cancer. The cause is felt to be human papillomavirus. And we're talking a little bit about some recent research that's led to some hopefully amazing immune therapies for cervical cancer. And if you've got questions or comments, a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Local number 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. So Dr. Henrich, tell us a little bit more about the HPV virus, and in particular, I'm interested in asking how sure are we HPV is the cause of cervical cancer or a cause of cervical cancer?
So the connection between HPV and cancer of the cervix is absolute. It's virtually always involved. There are some very, very rare circumstances where it is not, but in almost every cervical cancer, it's caused by infection with what's called a high-risk type of HPV. So the HPV virus comes in different flavors that are different immunologically, but functionally essentially the same in that they all put patients at high risk for getting cancer, and they cause cancer. They do this through expression of two proteins that are called oncoproteins. So these are proteins that actually cause cancer by targeting the normal proteins in cells that prevent cancer. And this leads to patients developing abnormal proteins and abnormal growth of the infected cells and acquiring invasive cancers that spread and cause harm.
My understanding is that the HPV virus is rather ubiquitous. It's hard to get through life without exposure, and to demonstrate that virtually all warts are caused by certain types of HPV virus. That does not mean that all warts are precancerous. I'm not trying to say that. If you listen carefully, and I want Dr. Henrich, you tell me if I'm wrong, but it's clear that certain of maybe somewhere close to 100 different types of HPV virus, many are not thought to be normally causes of cancer, but a few are very, very high risk for causing cancer. But it's hard to get through life without exposure. This has nothing to do necessarily with sexual activity, but sexual activity is a common way for these viruses to be transmitted. Am I saying anything wrong here?
No, that's right. They're ubiquitous viruses, and we're all passing them around to each other. And they're basically divided into two groups. One is the high-risk group, and one is the low-risk group. And the high-risk group are defined as the type that cause cancer, and the low-risk type generally cause warts. And, of course, it's the high-risk type that, you know, we're particularly concerned about here with cervical cancer.
The other thing that can be confusing, but I think is important to understand, is just because, let's say we know, and this is where physicians and scientists have gotten very creative. We number or name these HPV viruses very, very, very cleverly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So number 16 and number 18 among about 15 or 16 others are very commonly associated with cancers, not only of the cervix, but other areas of the body, which we will talk about perhaps here in a second. But it is not necessarily true that if you get one of those high-risk cancers that you will develop cancer. Is that true?
Right. So most of us, when we get an HPV infection, simply clear it. But in some cases, for reasons that are not understood, we have difficulty clearing the infection, and the infection goes on to cause a cell to become cancerous. And then that one cell multiplies, and that's how we develop a tumor.
And what's happened, Melissa, is that over a number of years, as this recognition that this infection causes cervical cancer, penile cancer, rectal cancer, vulvar cancer, and some head and neck cancers, is that perhaps we could prevent the transmission of those that virus by a vaccine. And so there's now vaccines that are able to prevent the infection if it's given before exposure. Is that true?
Right, that is correct. So in the last decade, HPV vaccination has become available, and the more common vaccine that was being used was a vaccine that contained the information for four of the most common HPV strains. The two that you mentioned, which is 16 and 18, that are responsible for, I believe, about 75 to 80% of the cervical cancers that we see. And then also in that vaccine, when it was created, they did put the two most common strains that were responsible for genital warts as well. As we mentioned, there are many, many strains of HPV. And actually, I've got a way that I think is pretty helpful for a lot of patients to explain HPV to them, because I think that it can be very confusing and overwhelming to people. And I tell them that when I say HPV, when you say HPV, it's just like saying the word dog. You say dog, and dog means a lot of things. Dog can mean a Doberman, or dog can mean a poodle. So the ones that cause the warts, I think of in the poodle family, and the ones that cause cervical cancer are more in the Doberman family. Apologies to any Doberman owners or any other kind of more aggressive type of a dog. But the point is that when you say HPV, it's just like saying dog. And so basically what that means is that, you know, they're the different viruses behave in very different ways. And so unfortunately, they have only up to this point put so many strains in vaccines. Although I believe that a newer version of the vaccination is either I don't know if it's actually available yet, or if it's closely coming down the pipeline, that has expanded the number of strains available to, I believe, 8 or 10. And I'm sure Dr. Heinrichs knows the answer to that. That will hopefully increase our coverage even more.
All right. We're at least halfway through this program, so I need to take a short break, and we'll come back and discuss some of Dr. Heinrichs' research on treatment of cancers. I really want to understand a little bit more about why the vaccine needs to be given fairly early, just so people can understand that. And it's always worthwhile that we talk about risk-benefit ratio, so we'll do that as well. If you've got questions or comments, please give us a call at our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we'll continue our discussion of cancers of the female reproductive tract with Dr. Hardesty and Dr. Christian Heinrichs. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Joining us today on Line 1 by telephone from his office at the National Cancer Institute is research oncologist Dr. Christian Heinrichs, and in the studio is Anchorage gynecologic oncologist Dr. Melissa Hardesty. If you have questions or comments, you can either email to line1@alaskapublic.org, call us locally at 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Remember also this program repeats as a recording in the evenings between 8 and 9. If you're listening then, we will not be able to answer your questions. I also want to briefly just mention that the fourth annual Gynecologic Cancer Awareness and Arts Healing Weekend is coming up February 5th, 6th, and 7th. Dr. Hendricks and Dr. Hardesty will both be there. Dr. Hendricks will be talking about his research, both to physicians and to the public. And if you want to get more information about what's going on and how to enroll, go to the website letEveryWomanKnow.org. There's a link to that website and to other educational sites about our topic today on our website at alaskapublic.org. Go to that website and find the Line 1 link. So just briefly again, the immune system is constantly surveilling, our immune system is constantly surveilling the environment and trying to very neatly decide what's at risk and what's not, and generating an immune response that, for all intents and purposes, is lifelong to protect us against these exposures that our immune system thinks is bad. So vaccines or immunizations are designed to fool the immune system into thinking they've had the infection, provide lifelong immunity without the risks of the infection. So if we're going to have some success with the HPV vaccine, which prevents an infection with viruses that are now known to cause cancer, we have to be given that vaccine before exposure. And often that causes problems for people like me, who's a pediatrician, trying to talk to mothers and fathers about starting vaccines for potentially sexually transmitted illnesses before they think we should be talking about these things. Do you run into the same problem?
We are not doing a lot of primary vaccination, just because at the point that the patients are coming to our office, we are really, they've already developed a condition for which vaccination is not necessarily indicated. When I worked for 4 years as a general OBGYN in the community, I don't necessarily feel like I ran into a lot of opposition to it. And maybe that's because I just was a pretty aggressive proponent of it, as opposed to being a neutral discussant. I think that we vaccinate against a lot of conditions that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be exposed to earlier on in life, early on during the vaccination period. I mean, hepatitis B is something that is given in the very early vaccination series. And, I think that I would hope that most people would consider that this is just another part of the routine vaccinations that would be administered. And that doesn't really, there's no harm administering it if your particular child doesn't necessarily get exposed to HPV vaccine, or the HPV virus. The, unfortunate thing is there's no real way to predict that. And once the exposure occurs, then the vaccination is much less effective.
Yeah. I think it's reasonable to say that once kids, young adults, become sexually active, their risk of acquiring these infections or becoming exposed is very high. There's very good studies suggesting that.
Definitely true. And part of the reason for that is that the way that the cervix is in a younger person is very different from that in an older person. There's a transitional zone on the cervix where it goes from one cell type to another, and that area moves as one ages. But when you're talking about a younger person, that area is very far out on the edge of the cervix, and so there's a big surface area for uptake of the virus. And I think that may have something to do with the ease of acquiring this virus in the younger population.
The next question people might ask is, what's the risk? It's one of the safest vaccines that we have. There's no live components to it. So the risk-benefit ratio is such that there's very, very low risk, and you're preventing potentially one of the most common cancers that women get or acquire. And that I'm looking at CDC data right now, is since the vaccine's been present, we've averaged about 1.8, almost 2% decrease in cervical cancer per year, suggesting that it is the an effective way to decrease these cancers.
And, you know, I would argue that we're going to see that go up astronomically because really we're just now starting to get into kind of real time seeing an effect of the vaccination on the incidence of cervical cancer because of the timeline that it's been out. It's only now that those young people are really getting old enough because although I mentioned we do sometimes see cervical cancer in women in their 20s, more commonly it's seen in late 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so we are just barely starting to get to the point where we are seeing vaccinated women come through that age range.
The other thing to emphasize that is that it's really very effective in preventing infection with the types of HPV that it's meant to prevent from infecting. So it's very safe, and it's very effective in preventing the infections.
And I'm just thinking, if I'm the public listening, it's very common for cancers to have their origins well before they become manifest. So the fact that you're infected maybe in early teenage years or younger and not having cancers till later is very well within the understanding of the natural history of cancer.
Right. Not only does it take a long time for the HPV-infected cells to start the journey towards cancer, that journey itself typically takes somewhere in the range of 10 years, although it definitely has some variation. So that's where pap smears come into play because cervical cancer has a pre-invasive phase. And what that means is there are changes that can be seen on a cellular level that are along the pathway to leading to cancer, but are not yet cancer. And that's what the purpose of a pap smear is, to detect those cells. And so that whole pathway really takes a considerable amount of time. And that's why I'm saying I think that we're just now starting to see a decline in the incidence of cervical cancer based on vaccination. And when you look at the data looking at that, they really looked at the development of pre-invasive lesions because that's something that could be studied in a reasonable amount of time.
Dr. Henrichs, not all women are protected. Some women get cancer, and some women who get cancer can have very aggressive kinds of cancer. And I'm assuming that you're involved in taking care of women who are having problems, or we're looking for new ways to treat women who do or have developed cancer. So before we talk about your clinical trials, your treatment experiences, and how you're doing it, tell us just briefly about the immune system. In particular, we ought to hear what a T cell is and how it is involved in preventing or attacking cancers that are already present.
So T cells are the part of your immune system that are evolved to fight primarily viruses and infections inside the cell. And each T cell has a very specific receptor on it that allows it to attack one particular target. And these targets are typically pieces of viruses. So what happens is that the virus infects the cell. It ends up inside the cell where the rest of the immune system can't see it. But pieces of the virus, fragments of proteins called peptides, end up adhering to immune molecules and then being transported up onto the surface of the cell where T cells can see them. And then it's T cells with particular specificity for a particular target that see that fragment of a virus on the surface of the cell and attack and kill the cell. And what's particularly powerful about the T-cell attack is that it's not just one cell that attacks. That cell with that one receptor replicates itself, and then those cells replicate themselves. And it builds up a huge wave of T-cells that are able to overwhelm the infected cell.
And so your research, if I can, I want you to tell me, correct me, is you're taking advantage of that natural immune response to try to treat cancers that are otherwise not being controlled?
That's exactly right. So the patients that we treat have very advanced cancers that have not responded to standard treatments. and can't be controlled by any established way of treating them. So in this setting, we test experimental therapies that are aimed at using the immune system to completely kill the cancer. So we obtain from the patients T cells, and then in the laboratory we manipulate these cells either by selecting the cells that are most able to recognize and kill cancer cells, or we can even actually genetically manipulate the cells to give them the receptors that allow them to recognize and kill the cancer cells. We expand these cells up to huge numbers in the laboratory and then give them back to the patients. And then we can further kind of tip the playing field in the favor of the infused T cells by giving the patients chemotherapy that's directed not at their tumors, but instead at their own immune systems, and helps to kind of wipe the slate clean for the new immune system that we grew up in the lab and that we give back to them. And this improves the overall immune response. And the idea is to give a single treatment, have the cells go everywhere in the body, completely eliminate all the cancer cells, just like T cells would naturally do in killing a viral infection, and completely eliminate the cancer and leave the patient cured after one treatment.
I have heard it said that many of us are developing cancers at various times in our body, and that often our own immune cell system, let's say T cells, are eradicating, controlling that so that at least it doesn't become an issue. Is that true? And then if so, what do we know about the reasons why it may get out of hand and our own immune system loses or does not have the ability to control the cancer?
So it's pretty hard to test if there are little microscopic cancers being cleared by the immune system all the time, but it's thought that that could happen. What we do know is that that we can grow up these cells to huge numbers, and they will find the small tumor deposits anywhere in the body and kill those.
And what are, so to help the listeners again, my understanding is you're taking these T cells, which are already beginning to recognize abnormal proteins on cells in the cervix or on this cervical cancer, grow them up or help genetically engineer them so that they're better at recognizing and doing their job of destroying those cells, and maybe add a little bit of chemotherapy, injecting, giving those back, and you're having some success. You want to describe your clinical trial, how many people were involved, what we know about the women that came into the trial, and what happened to them?
So at this point, we've reported the treatment of 9 patients with cervical cancer. These were the first 9 patients that we treated, and they all had advanced disease. Some patients had cancers that were caused by HPV-16. Others were caused by HPV-18. Some had squamous cell carcinomas. Others had adenocarcinomas. This just refers to the exact type of cell in the cervix from which the cancer grew out. And we had 3 patients who had major tumor shrinkage out of those 9. For one patient, the shrinkage was very transient, and it really didn't clearly benefit the patient. But for the other 2 of the 3, the tumors went away completely. And these were tumors that were spread all over the body. And at this time, both those patients are about 3 years out from that single infusion of cells, and neither one of them has any evidence of cancer that we can detect with X-rays.
This approach of using the body's immune system to, invigorate that body's immune system to help fight cancers is really spreading. It seems to me that when I'm not an oncologist, but when I read about some of the advances, this type of therapy is really where cancer treatment is going. Is that fair to say? And I'm talking about even outside of gynecologic cancers.
It's certainly a very exciting field of research right now, and we're finding that many different kinds of cancers can respond to immune-based treatments, but not all patients with these cancers have responses, and not all cancers can respond. So while it's exciting and we're finding more and more cancers that can be treated in this way, we're also learning what the limitations are and just what cancers are going to be effectively treated using this type of approach. And as you alluded to earlier, there's kind of a paradox in that we can isolate from growing tumors T cells and immune cells that are trying to attack these tumors. So the question is, how do we turn the balance in that tumor in favor of the immune cells so that they can completely eliminate the cancer? And the very interesting area of research right now is in a field of a class of drugs called checkpoint inhibitors or immune checkpoint inhibitors. And these are drugs that block signals from the tumor to the T cells that are telling the T cells to stop attacking the tumor. And these treatments typically have very low side effects. They're well tolerated, especially compared to traditional chemotherapy. And when they work, they can work for long periods of time and cause really meaningful cancer regression for the patients. So this is a very interesting area of research, and we're increasingly understanding in which patients these drugs work and in which types of cancers.
Let me just one more time let people know you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. We're talking about right now, we're talking about HPV and some exciting new research with using the immune system to treat advanced cervical cancer. If you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. I got one email that came in, and the question is from a woman who says you would like to know whether drugs or medications associated for being used for years for fertility treatments, and let's throw in birth control pills and so forth, provide any jump start or extra fuel for potential GYN cancers in middle-aged women. So let's assume this woman is asking, well, I've been exposed to HPV. Most women have. I've been on fertility drugs, birth control pills. Does that combination of things increase her risk for any GYN cancers with time?
So I think that it depends on which cancer you're looking at, and they're difficult questions to answer, primarily because when a woman is in a situation where she finds herself needing fertility assistance with medications, there are also other things going on with that woman that may modify their particular risk of cancer. So if we're talking specifically about cervical cancer, I don't think that there is any association between fertility medications and the development of cervical cancer that I'm personally aware of. There is some suggestion about a modification of risk of cervical cancer with the use of oral contraception pills. But again, that's one that's a little bit challenging because people using oral contraceptive pills may have other lifestyle characteristics that may also modify the risk. So I don't think that association is a cut and dry one as much as one might like it to be. So I think that if there is a risk, it is relatively small. And the thing about oral contraceptive pills is that while there might be a small increase in the risk of cervical cancer, there is also a clear decrease in the risk of uterine and ovarian cancer, both of which are much more likely for a woman to develop. So a woman's lifetime risk of uterine cancer is 1 in 70. That's ovarian cancer. And a woman's risk of uterine cancer is 1 in 35. And birth control pills lower the risk of both of those. So I think that there is probably agreement that in general, birth control pills are associated with a net decrease in the risk of women's reproductive cancers. With regards to other cancers, I just mentioned that birth control pills are definitely associated with a decrease in both endometrial and ovarian cancer. And I'm not going to get into why that is because it would take too long. I think it's unclear as to whether or not fertility, other medications for fertility enhancement are associated with ovarian cancer. I think most of us think it's not, although there is some conflicting epidemiologic data with regard to that. And I think it's difficult to sort out because those women also have infertility issues and there's a clear association between never having had a pregnancy and the risk of ovarian and endometrial cancer.
Okay. Dr. Henricks, back to you, if you don't mind. This is always exciting when you see somebody with advanced cancer, their cancers melt away, undetectable for 3 years after treatment. What's the hypothesis about why some of these women that was successful and others were not? Too late, wrong antigen, things we don't understand. What's the thoughts?
So that's a really good question, and it's tough to answer. So we are doing work to try to get to the bottom of it, though. One thing that we have found is that the patients who receive cells with good reactivity against the HPV antigens did better. That is, the greater the magnitude of the reactivity, the ability of the T cells to attack the HPV antigens, the more likely it was that the patient would experience tumor shrinkage after treatment. Now, we've studied that more because on the surface it makes it seem like it's the cells with reactivity against the HPV antigens that are doing all the work of making the tumors go away. But as we've dug deeper, it seems that that may play a role, but also it looks like there's a lot of reactivity against other abnormal proteins in the tumor that are present in these patients too. And so the reactivity against the HPV antigens may represent the primary way that the infused immune cells and infused T cells cause the tumors to go away, but it might actually be reactivity against other abnormal proteins that's just as important or even more important. One issue that we've run into, of course, is that if the patients don't have good reactivity against the HPV antigens in the cells that we grow out, there's really nothing we can do. The most you could do would be to say, just not administer the cells and expose them to the other risks associated with the treatment, which is very unsatisfying. So the next generation type approach that we're using uses gene engineering, where we simply take the patient's peripheral blood T cells. We can harvest these cells with kind of a blood draw type procedure. And then we genetically engineer all of the cells with a receptor that lets them attack and kill tumor cells that have the viral antigen that we're targeting. And this is a way to ensure that every patient gets cells with good reactivity against these viral tumor antigens. So we actually have a clinical trial testing that's open now, and another clinical trial in the pipeline testing a really kind of a third generation approach. The other possibility that we're exploring fairly intensely is that these cells that we infuse may be able to attack the tumors, but as I mentioned before, the tumors can also express inhibitory molecules that make the T cells stop attacking. So in our next clinical trial, we'll be giving these genetically engineered T cells that can attack the tumor based on the tumor expression of these HPV antigens, but we'll also be giving a drug to block the tumor from sending those inhibitory signals to the T cells.
So hopefully the public can understand this. Basically, in a nutshell, this is evolution going on. All of these infections, these viruses attacking cells have been going on for eons, for a long period of time, and cells adapt themselves. The virus adapts itself, so it can even make anti-cancer chemotherapy drugs just because it blocks the effects of this. I don't know. I'm not using the right word, but this attachment or this recognition system. So it's really constantly trying to figure out what's the mechanism on a molecular basis, and then try to work our way around that. That's really at the crux of what you're trying to do.
Yeah. So these tumors have ways of avoiding immune attack, and some of them are just to make abnormal immune proteins that mess up the ability of the T cells in the immune system to recognize them, and those are very difficult to address. But another way that the tumor shuts down the T cell attack is by expressing inhibitory molecules that connect with another molecule on the T cell, and when that happens, the T cell receives a signal that says stop attacking that cell and just shuts down. So there's this whole class of drugs that block that interaction, that T cell shutdown, that are proving effective in a number of different kinds of cancers now.
This is fascinating work. I got to say, I wish you the best luck. I think it's a great, great, great puzzle to try to figure out. I'm sure that's what's driving a lot of your interest to stay in this area of research. And our best wishes for that.
Thank you,
Dr. Hardesty. Let's back up just to the real world again. What is it? One thing or a couple of things you wish most women who probably should be listening, if not listening to this program, wish they knew about gynecologic cancers and preventing them?
I think really at this point, based on the knowledge that we have, vaccinate both your sons and daughters against HPV virus. Get pap smears when your provider recommends them. And please, please, please go and see your physician if you have any abnormal bleeding that is outside of a normal monthly period, or any bleeding or discharge after you have menopause. Those are, I think, the things that are actionable at this time.
I've alluded to it but didn't say it. There are a number of other cancers outside of the reproductive system that are also now very highly associated with HPV. And what is not the official reason for the HPV vaccine, which is the commonly one in Alaska, is called Gardasil 9 now, is head and neck cancers. So there's plenty of reasons for boys and girls both to decrease transmission, but to also protect themselves. I want to say very, very much my thanks to both of you for taking the time to be here. It's been a wonderful show from my standpoint. I'm sure the listeners appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to continue this conversation on gynecologic cancers, HPV, and cancer immunotherapy, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website, www.alaskapublic.org. Also there, you'll find Line 1 archives. You can refer people to this program at that point where they can listen to it later, or you can listen to other programs as well. Glaucoma is actually one of the leading causes of blindness in the United States, and the most common form of this disease has no warning signs, so that the loss of vision that it causes is very gradual and may not be noticed until too late. Next week, we're going to discuss this with Dr. Kelly Lorenz on Line 1, Your Health Connection, at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron and Eric Bork were engineering today's program, and Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.